Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. I'm your host, Ben from Blazers Edge, and with me, as always, Kevin Pelton from Basketball Prospectus and the Indiana Pacers. Kevin, you guys have a top 10 pick this year. Who are you going to take?
Well, I'm pleased to reveal here on the Wingcast that we will be taking the best player available at pick 10.
You know, I was pretty convinced you guys were going to win the lottery. How convinced were you that you were going to turn that 1% chance into a top 3 pick?
You know, I would say cautiously optimistic. As I mentioned, just like you guys with the Blazers, I had the excitement of great lottery joy back in 2007. So I've been there before, and I thought it'd be funny that time. You know, it was like 100 people gathered in the offices of the Sonics and Storm, and we're all watching it. And the third pick comes up, Atlanta, and people are just hugging. And you know, nobody even cared that we got the second pick and not the first pick, because it was just wanting to get one of those top two picks and get either Oden or Durant. And yeah, it was a pretty wild scene. So I was trying to compare what it would be like if the Pacers had jumped up into one of those top three picks here, and it would just be me celebrating by myself and everyone else thinking that I was a lunatic, basically.
Everyone already thinks you're a lunatic. That wouldn't have been any different. That would have just been a normal day. What was the special part about this?
Well, this time I wasn't ripping off my tie and throwing it down towards the court and getting kicked out. So,
yeah, well, that's a story for a different podcast. Hey, so, and if you had gotten the top three pick, you probably would have gotten the number one pick. You would have had John Wall, and your life would be complete. If you guys had gotten the number one pick and John Wall, would you have moved to Indiana?
I would try to become part of John Wall's entourage, actually.
I'm looking for a roommate is why I ask, because I'm okay. Getting ready to just completely stalk the crap out of this. Not in a negative way. He's the kind of player that you would follow across the country. Am I right?
Yeah, stock has such a negative connotation to it now. People don't ever think about the positive elements of it that you're thinking of.
Exactly. You know, all the publicity. Now, John Wall, I'm so excited. It really was his coronation day yesterday, wasn't it? I mean, they had the live shot with him. He looked not really overjoyed, a little bit perturbed. But, I mean, this guy has a transformational ability. The NBA is not going to be the same after he steps on the court. Would you agree with that statement?
I don't know about that. I was impressed, by the way, that within 5 minutes of the Wizards winning the lottery, you had tweeted out in one tweet every single possible, like, lame catchphrase or slogan that people could use about it, like Mr. Wall goes to Washington. I figured you were just kind of trying to like get in there and stake your claim to all of those so you could say that whatever the Washington Post put as their headline this morning, that they were copying you.
Well, you know, the reason why I was able to do that is because I came up with lists like that for every single franchise. You realize that, right? So I just had a notepad of 15 potential headlines for every single lottery team. I even had some for the Blazers, but last, you know, it turned out they didn't win the lottery, even though I was kind of hoping they might. Even though they didn't have any of the lottery balls, I thought maybe they could kind of swing it. Anyway, let's get back on topic here. John Wall and the Pacers is not going to be a go. Can you give us an idea of, I know you can't talk specifics, as I've been trying to beat out of you here for the first 5 minutes of the podcast real awkwardly, but give us an idea for the preparation process for a team like you're in, just generally speaking. Now, you know, you've had all the college, all the European players, basically, you've finished evaluating their statistics by this point, correct?
Well, I don't think you're ever finished evaluating them. You know, there's so much that can be taken from them.
So to rephrase, you've finished assembling them, right? I mean, you've got all the information you're going to work with at this point, and now it's about ranking and fitting and maybe, you know, getting a first list together before the group workout stage, or is it just a free-for-all at this point?
You know, there's been an overall evaluation process and, you know, a general overall ranking, and I think it's more, as you get towards the draft, it's about looking at specifics of guys who could be in the area where you're picking.
Got it. So positionally, are you doing anything positionally? Or is it just sort of, you know, like you said before, best player available? There's always like contingencies on best player available, because you've got a guy like Danny Granger. You don't necessarily need to, you know, consider Wesley Johnson number two on your board as best player available, right? Because, you know, there are going to be a lot of overlap in their two skill sets, correct?
Well, I'm a big believer that, you know, in almost any scenario, there's always an element of best player available. And with a guy like Danny Granger, he's able to play both the three and the four, played a lot of that last year, as a stretch four. So, you know, you could go a lot of different directions. But no, I wouldn't say that, you know, I mean, I think there's a positional element in terms of if you compare guys positionally. So looking at, you know, different players, you know, head to head at the point guard or the power forward or the shooting guard or small forward or center, as opposed to just comparing a giant list of all the players at all the positions, it's sometimes a little easier. But you know, I think that everyone is in play at this point.
Okay, so let's talk about this class. Now, here's what is the general prevailing wisdom about this class, and jump in if you agree or disagree with each point. First, outside of Wall, it's a very weak point guard crop.
That's probably a fair assessment, but there's not a lot of depth at the point guard position.
Okay, number two, there's a lot of quality, potentially immediate impact fours and threes and fours, three slash fours and four slash fives. Kind of fours, now that broad definition of fours, there's a lot of impact power forwards in this draft.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
There's not a ton of centers with the real like high-end potential, but there's some guys who could be big bodies.
Yeah, I mean, and it depends where you classify guys positionally. But you know, is Cousins more a five or a four? I think he's probably more of a five, and he's a very good prospect. So
Oh, you think DeMarcus Cousins is a very good prospect?
I'm going out on the limb.
Yeah, I completely disagree with you. I think DeMarcus Cousins is overrated. I think he would be the worst lottery pick of any potential lottery pick. I think he's going to be the biggest mistake someone's going to make. You want to know why people compare him to Derek Coleman? Do you know who I compare him to?
Who you compare him to?
Eddie Curry. He's the next Eddie Curry.
You know who I compare him to, actually, is I think he's got some Zach Randolph tendencies, especially like on the offensive glass, the way they just move people out of the way and make their way to the boards. And then also, you know, he's got more athleticism, more like a young Zach Randolph, whereas now, after his microfracture, Randolph can't really jump, so he's just like earthbound, using his giant posterior to clear space underneath the glass. Cousins can do that, and then he can go up and get it. So I think it's going to be, you know, and that's not an entirely positive comparison, obviously, when I'm comparing him to Zach Randolph. But you know, I think there's elements of that. I think he's extraordinarily talented, and in terms of NCAA performance, you could argue that there was no one on a per minute basis who played better. I think he had, you know, of the major college guys, the best PER when John Hollinger did college PER.
Well, you know what DeMarcus Cousins' file and Mao Zedong's home have in common?
What is that?
Giant red flags. Giant red flags. Just these huge draped 24-foot by 40-foot red flags. I mean, this guy has a third of a brain, man. He is a nutcase. Head job. You know, and this is something about John Wall that gets overlooked, in my opinion. I don't think DeMarcus Cousins makes it through his entire freshman season, keeping his stuff together. Able to actually get out on the court, not getting himself ejected for more games, not having huge run-ins, getting suspended from the team, messing up off the court. I don't think he's able to make it through his freshman year of college unless he's got a player of John Wall's caliber as a leader on the team, on and off the court, setting an example to keep him on the straight and narrow. Am I being too hard on him?
I mean, we're not in the locker room, so you know, we have no idea. Maybe it was John Wall who was a bad influence on DeMarcus Cousins at times.
Absolutely not. John Wall's a saint. He's like Dorothy Mantooth of this draft. Okay, you can't say a negative word about John Wall, or I'm gonna flip out. No, but I'm overstating things about Cousins a little bit. But you saw the tweet that Adrian Wojnarowski had about how the Blazers might move up into that 3 to 4 range, and look at the Nets and what the Timberwolves might be doing, and try to make a play for one of those picks. And some people were throwing out some of the names, like, you know, Wesley Johnson, DeMarcus Cousins, Derek Favors. Those are the guys who are in that kind of group right there. I think there's a better chance that LeBron James would be a Blazer than DeMarcus Cousins would be a Blazer. That's how strongly I feel about DeMarcus Cousins' off the court issues, his maturity questions, the fact that he's already, you know, roughly 270, that could balloon to 320 real quick after one NBA contract. I don't know, man. I would steer clear of him, and
Sure.
You know, he's perfect for the Minnesota Timberwolves to get lost in their front court, which is already a disaster with Love and Jefferson. They don't know how they're going to play together. I think he's a perfect fit at number four for them, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's not a great fit for him, as you point out. Without going too far and acknowledging the elephant in the room, doesn't that depend a little bit on who's making the decisions for the Blazers? Because obviously, when you look at Kevin Pritchard's philosophy and the importance he places on culture, and you know, I think we've heard stories about talented players who have been taken off their draft board because they just had too many red flags in the Blazers' eyes. And, you know, guys that were on almost everyone else's draft board, possibly. So, you know, from that standpoint, yeah, it's hard to see Cousins being there. But if it's not Kevin Pritchard's decision, then that could be a little different.
Well, unless they're replacing Kevin Pritchard with Master P, I don't see how the Blazers are going to trade up from 22 to 4 to grab DeMarcus Cousins. So I feel pretty confident in my declaration. And this is not to say that I think LeBron James is going to be a Blazer. Quite the opposite. But I do think there's a better chance LeBron James is in a Portland uniform next year than DeMarcus Cousins. So let's switch this gear to, okay, so who is it that the Blazers would be looking at in that 3 to 4 range, and why would they be looking at that player? And really, how does this rumor even get started about how the Blazers might move up? And maybe I'm playing a little detective here, I'm decoding a little bit, but what I think, you know, the way that tweet was worded about how the Blazers might move up and Houston might move up into that 3 to 4 range, to me it sounds like, okay, somebody heard that the Blazers and the Rockets both share a real affinity for a player in that range, and they're going to be going up to target that specific player. In other words, they're not going up to have the option at 3 or 4 to pick from a bunch of players. They would be moving up to try to grab a specific player. When you look at the guys who would be in that range, Favors, Cousins, Aminu, Johnson, Aldrich, maybe Greg Monroe or Ed Davis, and you're thinking from the Blazers' standpoint, am I crazy to think that it's Wesley Johnson and all the rest of them? I mean, it seems to me like Wesley Johnson would be the most obvious candidate there, wouldn't he?
I don't know. I mean, when you look at what the Blazers have on hand right now in terms of Nicholas Batum is clearly established with his performance last year that he's your guy for the long term going forward at small forward. You know, I think that there might be a desire to add more another athletic, you know, 6'10" type guy to the front court who can maybe play behind LaMarcus Aldridge, you know, that was part of that whole, I guess this was more undersized guys, but when you're talking about Paul Millsap and David Lee last summer, but then again with Marcus Camby in for at least the next season and signed for 2 years, then, you know, where are the minutes coming from for that guy? So, I, you know, my perspective in reading that is I think that's one that's getting generated by the teams at 3 or 4. One of those teams at 3 or 4 is trying to drum up interest in their pick because of the fact that they want to move it. And as you elucidated, there's reasons why the Timberwolves would potentially want to move down if they're unable to try to trade up and potentially get Evan Turner.
All right. So it doesn't sound to me like you're very high on Wesley Johnson. Here's my argument for why the Blazers might be targeting Wesley Johnson, right? It goes back to what KP's saying about the whole, you know, wins above replacement player or value above replacement player in terms of if you look at the Blazers roster, where is their, you know, fat they could possibly cut? The only guy really on the roster who's making more perhaps than he's producing right now, and I wrote about this maybe, you know, a month or two ago, is Martell Webster. And he's still fairly paid, you know, but they've got so many guys on rookie deals. He's really the only guy that maybe you move and you think, okay, well, we can trade him in for a rookie. And maybe you think Wesley Johnson is a more talented version of Martell Webster. You know, obviously he's already 22 years old. He's proven, he's got pretty good stats, good shooting percentage numbers, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe he can do a little bit more athletically. Potentially maybe he has the ability to be a better rebounder than Martell Webster. You know, maybe he's the guy that you bring off the bench behind Batum and he's you know, in a scoring role, maybe able to do a little bit more offensively. You know, I guess he probably has some of the same knocks that Webster does in terms of his ability to get to the free throw line and create his own shot. Maybe you think that can come. And so maybe what you're doing is you're trading Webster in to move up the board, maybe with some other picks, maybe with some other players, you know, potentially Rudy Fernandez. Maybe one of those two guys, one of those two backup wings for the Blazers would make sense for a team like Minnesota. Obviously, they're really short at 2 and 3, and maybe that's where the match is coming from. Maybe that's where some of this chatter might be able to evolve along. Would you agree there's potentially a match there, or is the Blazers just don't have enough pieces to get all the way from 22 to three or four.
I think the Blazers do have the pieces to get there, but it's the guys that they aren't going to want to trade. It's the Batums and the veteran core of the team that are the guys who have value. I mean, I think Bayless even more than perhaps Fernandez and Webster has value on the trade market. But again, you're creating another hole if you trade your backup point guard. So no, I just, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see any chance the Blazers trade that far up. You know, if they trade up to maybe the late lottery into that 12-14 range, something like that, potentially to try and get, you know, another valuable piece and maybe consolidate some of the picks that they have and, you know, the assets that they have because of the fact that, you know, you need a B-plus guy more than you need two C-plus guys in that, from that standpoint. But getting up to three, I just don't see it.
Well, so here's my question for you. When you look at this crop, is there a B-plus guy in that 10 to 15 range? See, I'm not sure if there is. I mean, can they do better? Here's some of the names in that range. You got Ed Davis. I think he's still kind of a project, just 2 years out of Carolina, missed a lot of this year with injury. Patrick Patterson, Donatas Motiejunas. Is it for sure he's going to come over?
The deadline to withdraw has not passed for international players, so I believe that he would still have the opportunity to withdraw. Although he may be age eligible, I don't know for sure.
Daniel Orton, no way in hell is he going to be a Blazer. Same thing with Cousins. Hassan Whiteside, perhaps maybe he's a project that you would move up to grab, but, you know, he's a seven-footer. I mean, Xavier Henry, is he a guy that gets your blood going? And maybe you say this guy can do the same things that Rudy can do, and maybe he's not such a whiner about it. Maybe we move up and flip Rudy in one of our picks to move up and grab him. Is that a potential?
You know, the one thing I'll say, and I'm going to be more circumspect on the players in this group because these are some of the players from which the Pacers will be choosing, but most of these guys are guys with 1 or 2 years of college. There's a couple in there with three. In terms of Patrick Patterson, I think maybe he's the closest to a Portland mold. If you look at the guys that Kevin Pritchard has targeted, they've generally been NBA-ready players. You know, LaMarcus Aldridge only had 2 years at Texas. Holden only had the 1 year at Portland. But those guys were projects in the same sense as some of these guys are, where they're going to have a tough time stepping into the Portland rotation and displacing one of the guys that's already in there. Yeah, to that standpoint, I understand what you're saying about it not being likely to make that move.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to take a project in this draft, don't you just take the project at 22? You know,
mm-hmm.
Do you need to give up an asset to go take that project? See, that's the question that I'm having, and perhaps they've got one of these guys, maybe a Xavier Henry, who may have a draft day slip because, you know, I'm not sure what the questions would be about him. Maybe it's mental makeup, I'm not sure. But, you know, maybe he has a slide, and so they do what they kind of did with Bayless, where they do it, go up and draft him. But I'm not really sure if they're in that mode right now. I think if it comes to taking a project, don't you just take him at 22? And then at 22, if you do decide to draft, are you going to take a project, or are you going to take one of these potentially, you know, impact fours and just have a little bit, you know, a little bit greater depth in your front court? I think that's probably the way to go. You know, one other thing to keep in mind here, I think, with the Blazers draft strategy is, and you know, I can't really talk about how I got some of these names, but, you know, I have some of these names, the Blazers, you know, I know the Blazers have had, you know, noticeable interest in the past, specific names in the recent past that they've been interested in. You know, one thing that I noticed about these names, a lot of the guys did not stay in the draft. So I think when the Blazers are looking at the top of their board, I think they've probably got some holes where there was guys who they thought were going to be in it who maybe, you know, aren't in it. And some of those names include, you know, John Henson, North Carolina. He's the guy with the, I think he's got what, a 37 foot wingspan. I think he was in that dinosaur draft that the Free Darko ran. You know, just crazy freak athlete. You know, another guy would be Kyle Singler, who'd be able to chill in that corner, shoot the three ball, and maybe, you know, defend a couple positions adequately off the bench. Another guy is the guy from overseas, Jan Vesely. He pulled himself out of the draft. That's, you know, that's a route that they could have gone maybe if he had, been able to fall down to where they were at 22. You know, he's not going to be an option anymore. So they've got guys who they were interested in recently that are not in the draft. And I think every team probably has that, but I think for the Blazers, you know, maybe more than some others, you know, that thinned out maybe who they were targeting a little. Now, obviously there's guys that they like John Wall and Evan Turner that everybody likes that just simply aren't going to be options for them. So then they're going to have some serious questions at 22. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, there's a couple things I could see happening. One, they can get one of these teams to bite on a guy like Martell Webster, move up and grab a pick that, you know, a player that they think could be better than him. Or two, I could definitely see them trading out of the first round and using their second round pick, which isn't super late. I think it's smack dab in the middle of the second round. I could see them grabbing a power forward from that group of guys, that includes, you know, Larry Sanders, who's probably going to go in the first round. There's also, you know, Deion Thompson from North Carolina, another guy, Trevor Booker from Clemson, I think the Draft Express has the Blazers slotted to grab. I mean, there's a bunch of those, third and fourth year power forwards. I think there's going to be one of those guys available at 44 that maybe takes some of the pressure off using that first round pick. Then you don't have to pay the guy, you know, a huge guaranteed contract like you would with the first round pick, and you've got some flexibility. And you save a little bit of money too. So I could see two things happening. I could see the Blazers trading up. I could definitely see them trading out. You know, at 22, I think that the question they've got to decide is there one of these power forwards or is there one of these front court guys who's going to be available, an impact guy who's going to be significantly better than another guy they could grab at 44. And I'm not convinced that the talent gap between 22 and 44 is that great this year. How would you read that?
Well, the one thing they have to be worried about is the fact that at 44, they're picking, you know, four spots behind the Pacers' first second-round pick. So that's an important consideration, I would say.
But you're going to steal whoever they want. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is precisely what I'm saying. I think that's a fair point. And, you've also got to compare it to the fact that Dante Cunningham has been a guy who's, you know, demonstrated that he can play legitimate minutes in this league. Now, if you grab a power forward who's maybe a different style than him, who's a longer power forward, and gives you something that maybe you don't have coming off the bench in the front court, then that's a little bit different than, you know, taking someone who's fairly similar and possibly not even better than Cunningham. You know, there was a long period of time, it seemed like, where a lot of people had the Blazers attached to one of those kind of under threes with who are maybe converted fours from college. So Quincy Pondexter is the local guy and obviously a personal favorite, and then Damian James from Texas. Do you think that at this point that's not something they'd look to address because of the fact, I mean, you know, you don't have a true backup small forward on the roster without Travis Outlaw, but then again, both Fernandez and Webster can certainly play that position. So,
well, I think Webster is your backup three. I think, you know, I would consider Pondexter and James both to be in that same group of power forwards that we were talking about before. And that's what I'm, you know, kind of getting at in the value assessment from 22 compared to 44 is I think you've got so many of those 3/4s or the undersized fours, you know, and all kind of with their own little flavor. And I think there's probably varying degrees of interest on a lot of these guys. But, you know, I think there's such a glut of those guys that, you know, if you say you like six or seven of them, you know, maybe you don't have your top two or three available at 44, but maybe one of those guys is still there on the board just because every team doesn't need a three or four. You know what I mean? Especially the teams that are drafting at the top of the second round. I mean, they may not be going that direction. They may be looking for other impact positions. You know, there's always teams who are looking for projects rather than guys who are third and fourth year, you know, lower potential guys. So that's kind of how Blazers got both Pendergraph and Cunningham last year, and I think they'd be able to get someone in the second round the same way this year. Also, another thing they could do is trade up from that 44 spot within the second round. So if they're worried about one of those guys maybe not being there, maybe you can throw in some cash and swap picks and, you know, get up into the 30s if you're really worried about one of those guys disappearing. So I think, you know, if they are looking to go that front court route, either they've got to really like someone in that group that makes them really want to pull the trigger at 22, or I think they're going to be able to find a fail-safe backup plan from that same group in the second round. That's kind of my read on it. And, you know, I like Damian James. You know, his rebounding numbers are nice. You know, I've come around on Pondexter thanks to all your cheerleading. There's a lot of guys in that group. I like Patrick Patterson, too. You know, I don't think he puts up the same rebounding numbers maybe as people expected him to, or maybe as some of these other guys do, but he can do a lot of things. He's versatile. He's a solid player. I think he's one of those guys that's going to be around for a really long time in the NBA. He's going to have staying power, if you will. You know, I'd much rather they go that route, than look at a project. Hey, here's one name that's come up on a couple mock drafts for the Blazers. Luke Babbitt from Nevada. What do you think?
Well, it sounds like reading that report lately that he may not be available, that Babbitt may be a lottery guy. right now. So.
So you're saying that if he was there at 22, the Blazers couldn't pass on him?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's you know, the opinion of a few teams that's developing that he's moving up the boards. I've never seen him play, honestly, so I don't know a lot about him.
I just hear he's a really good shooter, and the Blazers have talked about how they need a shooter, but you wonder, is the best thing to do to get a young guy and bring him in as your shooter, or are you going to try to explore that shooter hole via free agency? Hey, what do you think about the dream that's starting to circulate among a few of my fellow Blazer bloggers, Sheed from Bust a Bucket and Coop from Rip City Project are both starting to get on the J.J. Redick to Portland bandwagon, maybe using that mid-level exception, all or part of it, to snag him from Orlando and plug him in as your seventh or eighth guy who just comes in and lights it up and maybe, as part of a plan that involves getting rid of Rudy.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Coop talking about that on Twitter the last couple of days, and his arguments all make sense to the extent that, you know, this is kind of a showcase series for Redick where he's played some of his best basketball, but he's made himself a pretty good defender, which I don't think anybody imagined when he was coming out of Duke, and he's obviously a good shooter. He's someone who's kind of grown to accept and understand that role coming off the bench and probably would be able to play a few more minutes in Portland potentially than he can in Orlando because of the fact that they've got such a large group of swingmen led by Vince Carter and Matt Barnes and Mikal Pietrus. So, the Magic probably won't want to let him go. It could be a situation similar to Marcin Gortat where they recognize that they're overpaying for a bench guy, but they just want to keep him around as an asset so that they can trade him or something like that. But, you know, as far as somebody who could do the things that you will need coming off the bench, the one tough thing is I guess Redick's about the same. He's a little bit smaller than Rudy, so the Redick-Roy wing duo might be a little more problematic than Rudy and Roy, although, you know, Rudy is certainly not a big guy by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, you know, Rudy probably has a little bit more flair when people blow by him off the dribble than Redick might, so if you're into that kind of showmanship, maybe Rudy's a better defender. But, no, I think that Redick can handle things defensively, you know, at least as well as Rudy in that situation. I'm not crazy about Redick. I think he definitely has had a nice playoffs, and he's a solid player. You know, I was impressed by his little interview he gave with Bill Simmons where, you know, he was really selling the idea that he was all about winning and he was, you know, come to terms with, you know, settling into a bench role and being able to, you know, come in quick when, you know, necessary and start popping, right off the bat, basically. And that's – I almost kind of wanted to play his interview with Simmons for Rudy and be like, Rudy, this is what you need to listen to. You need to absorb this information and really take it to heart because if you had this kind of attitude, you know, your life would be so much better. You'd be such a happier person, and the team would be doing much better. But I guess that's kind of what happens when you do actually achieve the kind of winning that the Magic had. In other words, when they go to the finals, they come back and have another really strong year. It's a lot easier to buy into a situation like that than it is the Blazers situation where there was all these injuries, you know, minutes were kind of floating around and Rudy just kind of felt like he maybe should have gone some where he didn't. Would you agree that it's easier to buy in when you're winning, you know, roughly 60 games even in compared to when you're winning roughly 50 games when you're, you know, a number one, a number two, a number three seed compared to being a number six seed? Is that a totally different tier there in terms of getting guys to buy-in, or is it all about a culture, maybe? Or is it a personality thing?
Well, without question, it's easier to get guys into buy into their roles, and I think there's several reasons for that. First off, if you're winning that many games, you've obviously got a ton of talent, so it's not a situation where, you know, Rudy's fighting with Martell Webster for minutes. It's a situation where J.J. Redick's behind Vince Carter, who happens to be, you know, no matter what you think of him, no matter the fact that he missed two late free throws yesterday, he's a borderline Hall of Fame type player. So, you know, it's harder for me to march into Stan Van Gundy's office and say, I should be playing over Vince Carter. Carter or something like that. I think that's an aspect of it. Guys are happier when you win. And then the other thing is I think that there's an element of maturation and adjustment, and it's a process. You know, J.J. Redick, this didn't happen when he came out of Duke. There were times where he was unhappy and was reportedly potentially going to consider demanding a trade or at least asking for a trade. But over time, he's figured out how he can be effective coming off the bench and still play a key role. So I think that the one of the differences here is that Redick basically had no choice. You know, he didn't have the leverage of, oh, I'm going to go back to Europe. And he wasn't in a situation where he was thousands of miles away from home and kind of felt isolated and things like that. So I think there's a lot of reasons why it may have been easier for J.J. Redick than it is for Rudy Fernandez.
So if Portland had a Disney World, do you think that Rudy would be happier?
Well, they'd have to have an Epcot Center so that he could go to the fake Spain section.
You think Rudy's a teacups kind of guy?
Matterhorn. I think the Matterhorn.
Oh, okay. All right. You know, good points, all. I think it would be an ideal situation, and normally ideal situations don't happen for the Blazers, so I don't think we're going to see J.J. Redick in a Blazers uniform. You know, that guy has a lot of scarves. I've noticed that about him. It doesn't really matter the weather or the time of year. That guy's kind of always rocking the scarves, and maybe him and Bayless could go shopping for clothes together. You know, I think that might be a nice little pairing. Probably the similar sizes. We could probably share clothes, actually, now that I think about it. We can go out and get their sartorial game on. All right, let's see. What else should we talk about in terms of the draft for the Blazers? Okay, one other line of questioning that's come up, people have been asking me, you know, hey, as always, do they go for the guards? Maybe they can find some value, even though it's a weak class. Everybody kind of agrees on that. Maybe they can get one of these younger guys, you know, Eric Bledsoe or Avery Bradley kind of being the two names, maybe towards the bottom half of the first round. Do they take a chance on one of those guys, increase their depth? Because, you know, they only have, what, Miller and Bayless at the point, correct? I mean, Diener and Patty Mills, I think, are both big-time question marks. Whether Mills will be back or not, it's hard to say. Do you look for a player who may have some potential there and slot him in as your third point guard and give yourself some increased flexibility if you do decide to move either Miller or Bayless at some point next year? Or do you address the point guard situation through free agency? Because, you know, it's going to be kind of a hole if they don't bring either one of those other guys back.
I mean, I think it depends mostly on who's available. But the other question there is, if you get a young guy like a Bledsoe in particular, 1 year of college, you know, has a lot of development in front of him, is he going to be able to get the minutes he needs to develop? Are you going to be able to develop him enough in practice because of the fact that he's not going to be in the rotation in all likelihood? You know, it's going to be fairly difficult to beat Bayless out for that spot, and certainly he's not getting the starter minutes as long as Andre Miller stays healthy, and guess what, he has his entire career. So that would be a little bit of a difficulty, I think, if you take a point guard in that position. But, yeah, it's really just a couple of guys that are there in that mix, I think, in terms of the first round for point guards after John Wall.
I totally agree with you. It's kind of a worst of both world situation if you're looking to address that position in the draft. Because like you said, one, you know, the guys in front of him aren't likely to get injured and they're going to sop up all the playing time, so you're not getting the development. But two, you know, if those guys were to somehow, you know, against all odds go down, those aren't guys who are going to be able to step in and play for you, and the Blazers are going to need someone to step in and play in that situation. And so, you know, it doesn't really fit, you know, either person's timeline. It doesn't fit the Blazers very well. It doesn't fit the player very well. So they're probably, you know, better advised to address the point guard situation somewhere else.
I would say, by the way, that Bradley might be an interesting fit next to Brandon Roy, though, in terms of someone who's not his, the weakness, the knock on him is that he's an undersized two guard. Well, you know, if you want Roy handling the ball a lot, and, you know, this has been the debate in the past, then someone who can come in and potentially be a plus defender against point guards, which is the upside that Bradley offers, and you mitigate some of his weakness in terms of distributing the basketball and being a true point guard, that, you know, that might not be a bad backcourt.
Well, the thing I like about Bradley is I'm not totally sold on his whole package yet, but I love his intelligence, especially on the defensive end. He just has a knack for being in the right place at the right time. Quick hands, you know, gets the deflections, gets the poke away on the guys, you know, on the bounce. Plays really hard, head's always in the game. So I think, you know, he's a nice prospect. He's a really nice player. He's the kind of player who you kind of wish had come along for the Blazers 2 years ago, and it would have been a perfect, you know, they could have been grooming him for the last 2 years, maybe instead of Bayless, and you know, he would be good to go. I'm not sure if – does he have the shooting ability or the range to play off, you know, to play off Roy at this point, or is that something that maybe could develop over a couple of years if he gets some tutoring from Monty Williams maybe? You know, he could be a fit.
He definitely have to work at that, yes.
You know, honestly, I think that Avery Bradley might go earlier than people think. I could see him being a top 15 pick.
Ford has been talking about him being in the lottery the last couple of days. So, yeah, I think that's definitely possible.
Yeah, so that probably wipes him off for the Blazers. I guess of all the guards outside of Wall, he'd probably be the one that would make the most sense for the Blazers. He's a nice player. It's nice to get some of these Northwest guys to run. We should probably just pretend we're part of the Avery Bradley fan club and just continue banging away on his drum, huh? Just talk about how he's the greatest player ever. There's no concerns with him. He's the next Rondo on defense.
Yes, I think that we should be supporting all the Northwest guys. And
no, I heard Terrence Jones is going to sign with the Cleveland Cavaliers as part of a package deal with Coach Cal and LeBron. Does that hit it for the draft? Is there anything else that you wanted to? Is there any prospects that we overlooked? Any guys who you think are diamond in the rough capabilities? Maybe the guys who are not getting their fair share of run?
Is this where I'm supposed to throw people off the scent for who I really want the Pacers to draft and send up some smoke screens?
Well, you know, on the same subject, this is going to be kind of a detour, so apologies to our listeners, but have you heard about in World War II, when Great Britain came up with this plan to basically have a dead body wash up on shore in Spain with the opposite of their plans for attacking the German Empire through Sicily, and instead of saying Sicily, the plan said they were going to do it through Greece and Sardinia, so the Germans recovered this body with the help of the Spaniards, read through the information that, you know, said, oh, yeah, the British made all this up, all these, like, fake documents about how they were going to attack Greece, blah, blah, blah. The Germans recovered it and then shifted all of their defense, not all their defenses, but a lot of their defenses to cover Greece and Sardinia, and then the Allies went through, like, and attacked Sicily like they were planning to do. Have you heard about this plan? Or have you heard about this?
No, I've heard of it.
Oh, well, Malcolm Gladwell had a piece in The New Yorker recently about it, and then there's this movie they made about it, and I guess there's a new book all about this this great deception. It's called Operation Mincemeat. So I was reading this article by Malcolm Gladwell, and it made me think of the NBA draft and throwing people off the scent like you were talking about, because it was almost so transparently obvious what they were trying to do, and yet because it confirmed what the Germans wanted, the Germans apparently didn't want them to attack through Sicily, but it kind of confirmed Hitler's opinion of, oh, it'd be great if they attacked through Greece. So he was kind of led to believe it, and it kind of was like the spy versus spy game of, like, I know what you're thinking, and I know you know what I'm thinking, and I know you know what I'm thinking. This whole game that gets played before the draft, you know, it's almost overwhelming. You know, do you even bother reading the tea leaves? You know, now that we have, you know, roughly a month until draft night, you know, you're a little bit more actively involved yourself. Are you focused on what you're interested in doing, or are you looking at, you know, all the reports about what other teams might be doing? Do you tune all of that out and just focus on what you guys are, or do you get involved with it? How do you handle that?
I mean, I don't know. You know, I think I'm like anyone else. I read, you know, the Draft Express and the ESPN Insider and that sort of thing, and get a general sense of it. But at this point, it's academic, the interest, is anything else.
So if the body washed up on the shore of Puget Sound? If a body washed up in the Puget Sound and it said, hey, who's drafting right in front of you? The Jazz. The Jazz are going to take Greg Monroe. And it looked like it was authentic, and it looked like it had been a letter from Larry Miller to Jerry Sloan, or I guess Larry Miller died, so it probably wouldn't be from him. But, Frank Lannan to Jerry Sloan, and the letter says, hey, we're going to take Greg Monroe. Would you believe that letter, or would you be inclined to think it was fake?
I think I would probably suspect it was fake. Now, if it was a tweet that I intercepted and decoded about it, that might be a totally different thing in 2010.
Very good. All right, hey, last thing real quick, and I know you got a real kick out of Kevin Pritchard's recent radio interview when he told Brian Wheeler that one of the things that they look at when they're assessing changes in the offseason is a player's warp, and the idea that you either need to get a better player or you need to get a player of similar warp at a cheaper value, and that's kind of how you go about improving your team. First of all, can you give, I guess, the general audience who's probably never even heard of our podcast, but maybe you can give a general overview of what kind of players warps tends to favor, or maybe like what kind of players tend to do really well on warp, or just a general sense of what warp is, kind of a 101 overview of warp as a method, because I know it's one that you tend to rely on a lot in your writing and also in some of your analysis pieces.
Well, I would say that there's two things, which is the general concept of warp, which I think is what Pritchard is talking about in terms of just being aware of replacement level and its importance, and knowing that you need to have players who are better than that, but also that replacement level is fairly high. That you know, the Warriors went out and got guys from the D League this year, and you know, they didn't win a lot of games, but they didn't embarrass themselves either. Reggie Williams played pretty well, so you know, there are these guys out here, so you don't necessarily need to overpay to chase the I can't think off the top of my head of who I want to sell out here as a guy who's right around replacement level, but you know, some sort of veteran.
What about like Richard Jefferson, right?
Oh, I don't think he's that low. I'm talking more like, you know, Michael Finley maybe is someone who
okay.
at this stage of his career is around replacement level, but he's hanging on because he's a veteran and he's a proven commodity and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's helped the Celtics, I suppose, but, someone like that, and you know, there's value. And I think Dante Cunningham last year was a great example of this. You know, the second round guy who came in and more than held his own when he got a chance to play. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is that you create value to your team by being able to stay on the floor and being better than replacement level. So both of those factors are relevant. This year, Brandon Roy, his warp wasn't as high as last year, both because of the fact they didn't play as well and because of how much time he missed. So that's a factor when you're looking at value to the team. As far as the specific version of warp that I use, you know, it's not tremendously different, I think, from any of the other all-in-one player rating systems, except that, again, by focusing on value as opposed to per-minute production like PER does, it's a little bit different there, and I think it values defense better and now maybe has a better grasp on the value of being able to stretch the floor with some of the adjustments I've made to it that are starting to trickle out. So, but, you know, I don't think that's at all what Pritchard's referring to. It's more the general concept.
Okay, so if you're looking just at the Blazers roster, generally speaking, you're looking at their warps, which guys kind of stand out to you? Now, are you always looking at warp with relation to salary? I mean, are those two kind of always tied together where, you know, you're expecting higher salary players to deliver higher warp? Is it that clear of a relationship, or is there some more nuance to it?
Well, the one thing in the NBA is so much of it is tied to, you know, the salary cap, and, you know, I think one thing that Pritchard and company has shown a really strong understanding of is that when you get a guy locked into a rookie contract, they're almost always underpaid. So that's why it's so useful to spend $3 million buying one of those draft picks or something like that. So there's a different expectation for a guy who's on the rookie contract as opposed to someone who was coming from the restricted free agent market or even someone who's coming from the unrestricted market, which, you know, inevitably tends to be the least efficient from the team's perspective and the best from the player's perspective. So, you know, it's a little challenging to compare that, but like, you know, we used warp in our analysis of LaMarcus Aldridge's contract extension, which looked reasonably fair based on, you know, the warp he had put up over his first three seasons and how that historically had compared to the extensions players had received.
Yeah, no doubt. So, well, when I'm thinking, you know, through the Blazers and kind of just my general understanding of their warps, it seems like the guys who are being paid the most, guy like Marcus Camby, guy like Brandon Roy, guy like LaMarcus Aldridge, they're right in the ballpark for where you would expect for warp, right? None of those guys are standing out as being guys who are being way overpaid based on their warp.
No, I mean, Aldridge looks a little worse with the adjustments because he's not a three-point shooter, so that's taken him down. But Camby has always come out very well in the statistics, and then Roy, obviously, his numbers speak for themselves.
So is there any player, when he hears Kevin Pritchard going on the radio talking about warp, is there any Blazer who should feel like there's a big red X or a dot on his head, you know, where he's kind of in the sniper's line of fire here? Is there any player who should be getting concerned where he hears warp? Because it seems like to me, like you're talking about with the rookie contracts, and we talked about this before, it seems to me like this is kind of a money ball roster at this point, you know? Maybe a guy like Joel Prisbilla with the injury and his salary figure, maybe he's a guy who would be worried. A guy like Martell Webster is kind of right at that average, you know, replacement level line where he's getting paid $4 million a year compared to guys maybe who are on rookie deals getting a little bit cheaper. I mean, there's not a lot of fat to be trimmed from a warp perspective, is there?
No, I think you've accurately looked at the two guys I would mention. You know, Prisbilla, was perfectly reasonably played when he's healthy, but now that he's not going to, you know, necessarily be able to give you much of anything next season, that changes that math. And then Webster is a guy who hasn't been significantly above replacement level in his career, but is being paid a decent amount of money. But this is why, you know, when you look at the net wins per net dollars spent, or marginal wins for marginal dollars spent, I should say, that you know, I used to evaluate salary efficiency, that the Blazers were, I think, third in the league behind Memphis and Oklahoma City. You know, that'll go down next year when Roy gets off his rookie contract and is being accurately paid. But right now, they've got about as good a roster as you can get without spending much more than the salary cap.
So here's my last conclusion. This will be the final word, or after I get your thoughts on it. Does that lead us to the conclusion then, if KP's thinking about warp, if KP's looking at his roster, comparing it to the other rosters in the league, and, you know, looking at his players individually, their warps and compared to their salaries, is that leading him to the conclusion that this should be a quiet summer because the pieces are in place, the roster can't get much more efficient dollars-wise? Personality-wise, the only real wild card, I think, is Rudy Fernandez, but are all these signs and these you know, keywords that KP's throwing out there, like warp, I mean, is that leading us to the conclusion that he's pretty comfortable with where things are at, and well, he may let this thing germinate for one more year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think if you do see anything, it'll probably be of the consolidation variety. You know, maybe you send Webster and one other piece and get a slightly better small forward or something like you were talking about with the draft pick. So I think that, yeah, in terms of major changes, I think that the Blazers are probably pretty comfortable where they are.
Very good. Well, thank you for the explanation of warp. I hope that made sense to everyone. All right, enough draft talk. Let's talk playoffs. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas want to get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.